Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Dr. Philippa Kelly, educator and dramaturg. I'll be the moderator for today's program called Roads of Arabia, Archaeology and History of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The Roads of Arabia is the fascinating exhibit at the Asian Art Museum in San Francisco. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker for today, Dani Chan, Assistant Curator for Exhibition Projects at the Asian Art Museum. Actually, curator of this exhibition. Would you please all give a warm welcome to Dani Chan.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm here to introduce the exhibition Roads of Arabia, Archaeology and History of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which is currently on view at the Asian Art Museum through this coming Sunday, actually. So I hope through this presentation to entice you to visit the exhibition if you already haven't. So I first want to start off with this map. It gives you a geographical orientation of the Arabian Peninsula, but it also shows you the two networks of roads that are being referred to in the title of the exhibition. So in orange were the roads that were used by ancient traders for the lucrative incense trade. So the trade began in the southern part of the peninsula, and it moved northbound to carry incense to various ports that then connected to Africa, to the Mediterranean world, to Asia. And this trade lasted for over 1,000 years and ended around the 2nd century CE. The second set of roads, colored in green, represent the pilgrimage roads that were used by Muslims from outside of Arabia and within Arabia to make journey into Arabia to Mecca for their annual pilgrimage. And so, these roads brought pilgrims into Arabia. And so I like to start off with this map, and this map is also in the exhibition introduction, because it gives you in one snapshot a representation of the main idea of this exhibition, which is the Arabian Peninsula had served as a cultural crossroads over the thousands of years that this exhibition covers, because you can clearly see that both the pilgrimage roads and the trade roads connected to various other roads or trading networks outside of Arabia. So the region was not as isolated as we had previously thought. Now, the story actually begins earlier than the incense trade into prehistoric times, so we can almost say that there was a third set of roads featured in the exhibition. So archaeologists have found a handful of Paleolithic settlements, and in the exhibition we have a group of stone tools, the oldest dating to over 1 million years ago, essentially to the time of Homo erectus's migration out of Africa. So the current theory was that Homo erectus had moved up the Nile River Valley, crossed into the Levant, and then dispersed across the continent. However, now that we've found Paleolithic settlements throughout parts of the Arabian Peninsula, there is now a second possible route that is being suggested, which was Homo erectus doing a short Red Sea crossing into the southern tip of the peninsula, crossing the peninsula and then dispersing into the rest of the continent. So already we see the Arabian Peninsula being put on the map as a possible crossroads for early humans. Now, these three human-shaped stones can be regarded as among the earliest artworks to have come out of the Arabian Peninsula. About 50 of them have been found thus far, and the majority of them were found in the southern part of the peninsula in what is now modern-day Yemen. These three that are in the exhibition came from the northern part of the peninsula in what is now modern-day Saudi Arabia. And they were They are believed to have been used for funerary or religious purposes. They've been found in funerary deposits. They were also found lining the perimeter of an open-air sanctuary. And you can tell that there are differences in how the facial features are expressed and how articles of clothing are depicted, which may represent tribal differences that continue to this day. Yet, you know, for their age, they can rival any modern art piece that we know of today. Now, the majority of the objects in the exhibition date to the incense trade time period. We don't have records of the trade occurring any earlier than 800 BCE, and it lasted for, you know, till the 2nd century CE. And so the most popular form of incense that was traded, frankincense and myrrh, their trees only grew natively in East Africa and the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula. So essentially, this gave the southern Arabian tribes a near monopoly on the cultivation and trade of incense. And so, you know, via camel caravans, the traders would move northward and stop at various way stations or oases or towns or cities along the way. And these stopping points would provide shelter and food and protection to the caravans, but also they levied taxes on these caravans. And that was the main source of wealth for these towns and way stations. But this accounts for the fact that once, you know, incense reached one of the ports to get to the Mediterranean world, for example, the price of incense rose about 1,000-fold. And it turned out that the Roman Empire became the number one consumer of incense by the time the incense trade declined. And so the exhibition features art and artifacts that have been found at 5 major sites along the incense roads. And I had the liberty to organize these 5 sites according to the ancient foreign civilization with which each site has had the greatest cultural exchange or communication. So that the first 2 sites, Tarut and Tema, we clearly see suggestions of cultural exchange with Mesopotamia, which is now between Syria, Iraq, and Iran region. The third site, Al-Ula, had strong relations with possibly ancient Egypt and Sudan in Africa. And then the final 2 sites, which we will go in detail, had very strong connections with the Roman Empire and the Greco-Roman world. So we're going to start off with Tarut. It's an island located in northeastern Arabia. And, you know, for the longest time, we've had textual evidence of trade relationships between Mesopotamia and Tarut. However, only recently have we had visual evidence of this connection. So an example being this rare statue of a man that was found accidentally, actually, on Tarut Island. It stands about 3 feet tall, made out of limestone. And scholars are actually comparing this Arabian statue with the more well-known Mesopotamian prayer figures. And just by seeing them side by side, there are certainly similarities in, you know, the bald head, the articulated bulging eyes, and especially in the posture of the right hand clasped over the left, which in the Mesopotamia example is a posture of worship or prayer. Now, since the Arabian statue was not found in situ, as we say, on site, it was found by accident somewhere along the road, we don't know its original context, so we don't know whether it had a similar religious or sacred context as the Mesopotamian example. Now, in addition to Mesopotamia, we also have a group of chlorite vessels that can relate ancient Arabia to what is now modern-day Iran. So chlorite, as material, was a silicate mineral. It's greenish-gray, greenish-black in color. However, analyses have shown that these chlorite vessels found in Tarut were not native to the region. And we know of, in the third millennium BCE, the main production center for chlorite vessels was what is now modern-day southern Iran. And so it was very likely that chlorite was imported into Arabia in either a raw or semi-finished form. Because actually these decorated chlorite vessels are very common in the region in what is now West Asia. And the imagery, such as the tall vessel you see on the right, the imagery of two intertwined snakes, was also a common motif found in almost all the chlorite vessels you see in West Asia. However, if you look at the motif on the vessel on the left, depicting palm tree leaves, that is more distinctive to the Arabian motif, the Arabian imagery. Now, you know, you look at these two vessels here, they're monochromatic, they look very elegant and refined. However, we do have evidence that colored stones were probably inserted into some of the designs of these vessels. For example, such as the tall vessel with the intertwined snakes, there are almond-shaped impressions representing their scales that most likely had colored stones in them. So imagine the colorful contrast, if you will. Some would call garish, but that is very subjective. Now, the second site that had strong cultural exchange with the Mesopotamian world was Tema in northwestern Arabia. And Tema was renowned in the ancient world for its wealth, primarily due to the fact that it was at a major crossroads of the incense roads. And so one of the highlights from Tema include this fragment of a pedestal or altar that is decorated on two adjacent sides, one of the sides you see here, and on both sides feature Egyptian, Mesopotamian, and Persian imagery that were symbols of the divinity or of royalty. So on both sides, it features a bull with a solar disk in between its horns, and scholars are comparing this to the Egyptian bull deity Apis. Surrounding the bull, we also have Mesopotamian motifs of the winged sun, the eight-pointed star. And so, but yet all of these foreign imagery were used here in the service of a local god, Vam. And so you see sort of like the integration of local and foreign artistic motifs. And it clearly comes out in this funerary stele. Scholars call it an eye stele, primarily due to the schematic eyes and nose featured at the top of the stele. And this motif, this design of the eye stele, is very much an Arabian motif. However, underneath it, there's an inscription that names the deceased, commemorates the deceased, but it's in Imperial Aramaic, which is an imported language from Mesopotamia, specifically from Babylon. And this makes sense because we have records of the last king of Babylon, Nabonidus, who ruled in the middle 500 BCE. He had stayed at Tema for over 10 years, supposedly because he had worshipped gods that weren't accepted in Mesopotamia, but yet we know that while he was in Tema, he conducted raids into the surrounding areas for those 10 years, essentially trying to get control of the strategic location and its immense wealth. The third site is Al-Ula, the oasis of Al-Ula, just south of Tema. And the sculptures that were found in Al-Ula, they clearly show, or they strongly suggest, a connection with the sculptural traditions of Egypt and possibly Sudan. So take, for example, this is one of my favorite pieces in the exhibition. We have three of these colossal sculptures, When complete, they stood about 9 feet tall. And when you compare it with an Egyptian sculpture from the old dynastic period, which is earlier, it's about 3rd millennium BCE, there are certain comparisons one can make. One, their formal frontal posture are rather similar. Two, the emphasis on the idealized articulated musculature of both sculptures. I call the Arabian guy our six-pack man. And they were also found in similar sacred contexts. The Arabian sculptures were found in situ flanking the entrance to a major temple in Al-Ula. And finally, both sculptures were painted. So in the Arabian examples, you can see traces of red pigment on the exposed body parts, such as the torso or the legs, and the skirt was painted white, similar to the Egyptian example. Now, for all of their similarities, the Egyptian sculptures do have certain local markers. You can't see in the picture here, but he's wearing a distinctive Arabian headband. The belt around the skirt, and in particular, there's a ring around his left elbow that indicates that this statue represented a member of the local ruling class. And in fact, there is another sculpture that was found in the same temple that had an inscription of the name of a deceased ruler. So perhaps all of these colossal sculptures were representations of a deceased ruler. Now, the final two sites that I'm going to present, they definitely, clearly had cultural exchange with the Greco-Roman world, with the Roman Empire. So the first site is Taj in northeastern Arabia. And the objects that came out of Taj were primarily from two family grave tomb complexes, and they were primarily gold, gold, gold. There's gold jewelry, and certainly the highlight coming out of the Taj gold pieces are these funerary mask and glove that was found covering the body, the skeleton of a six-year-old girl. And, you know, when I first saw this, it struck me right away, oh, the mask of Agamemnon. And there are clearly similarities to Greek and Macedonian funerary masks and gloves that were more common to their burial traditions. We don't know enough about Arabian burial traditions to even compare in terms of ideology, but we know that the Arabian residents were aware of Greek or Macedonian models when making this mask and glove. We also have evidence of gold mining in the region, and so this gold most likely have been locally sourced, and the way that the facial features are schematized is more Arabian than, say, Greek or Macedonian. And of course, the mask and glove is scaled to the size of a young person. Now, the final site along the Incense Road is the southern city of Kiryat Alpha. And to date, this site is the most extensively excavated site along the Incense Road, which means that, you know, not only have we found tombs, archaeologists have found a necropolis, a residential quarter, and a marketplace. So the objects coming out of Kiryat Alpha were not only funerary and or religious, but there were also objects used in daily life, especially by the elite. And so because of this more comprehensive nature to the objects coming out of Kiryat Alpha, there I see about three different groups of objects that you will encounter. One, artworks that were expressing local traditions, local Arabian traditions. Two, artworks that were made locally, but yet showed an awareness or an influence of the Roman models. And then three, there were definitely artworks that were directly imported from the Roman Empire. So these two examples demonstrate the first. Alabaster sculpture, especially funerary sculpture, was very common in what is now modern-day Yemen, so just south of Kiryat Alpha, and made out of alabaster. And if you imagine, if you will, I didn't have a chance to put a photo in here, a vertical slab of stone, and a niche was carved out of that stone. Then one of these alabaster heads would have been fitted into that niche, and then just directly underneath, there would be an inscription commemorating the deceased. And also, if you notice, especially on the head on the right, you see black markings around, you know, the eyes, the eyebrows, and possible stubble-looking dots. So hair was actually represented by an organic material. So there were organic materials being inserted into where there would have been a beard or a hair to really try to differentiate the heads to make it possibly more look more like the deceased. But because these were organic materials, they've disintegrated, and all we have left are the bald heads, bald beardless heads. Now this fragment of a painted plaster painting, represents the second group of objects that you will encounter at Kiryat Alpha. They were made locally. These were found in the residential quarter. And the man on the bottom left, he is definitely, his hairstyle, his mustache is in the Arabian style, but yet he wears a crown of grapes, and there are grapevines and grape motifs surrounding him, suggesting a link to Dionysus, the god of wine and merriment, which we do have indications that it was a very popular cult in Kiryat Alpha. And then this bronze statuette of Heracles is an example of artworks that were directly taken from the Roman Empire, imported into the Arabian Peninsula. And it was definitely considered a luxury item for those who can afford it. Now, the exhibition at the Asian Art Museum offers a unique feature that actually you would not have found anywhere else for this traveling exhibition. So there, we included 9 examples of 9 different languages that were in use in the Arabian Peninsula at this time. And about 7 of these, I think, are dead languages, and they're organized according to their language families, so that you have examples of Old Arabic, Dedanitic, and Hagaric that had originated in what is now modern-day Saudi Arabia. Sabaic and Manaic were original to what is now modern-day Yemen. Imperial Aramaic and Nabataean originating in the region that is now Syria and Iraq. And then, of course, Greek and Latin from the Mediterranean world. And since the majority of these are dead languages, we actually have a listening station. The Nelson Atkins Museum in Kansas City had worked with the linguistic scholars at their local university, and you can hear these dead languages spoken, or how they most likely sounded like. And so, just to let you know, personally, I love Sabaic. I hope you listen to it and you can make your own judgment. So, by the time we get to the Pilgrimage Road section of the exhibition, we're jumping actually 400 years into the future. Since I had mentioned that the Roman Empire was the number one consumer of incense by the 2nd century CE, the government noticed that its treasury was depleting, in part due to this trade, and so they banned the use of incense as an indulgence. So with the demand decreasing, the trade basically became obsolete. And even though after the rise of Islam in the 7th century, demand for incense increased, the trade never reached its former glory. And so many of the roads fell into disrepair, and now we focus on Mecca, where the Prophet Muhammad was born and raised. And during the time of the Prophet Muhammad, Mecca and much of Arabia was relatively polytheistic. There was definitely a Christian community in Mecca. Judaism was practiced, in addition to the various local gods that have been worshipped at individual towns and way stations and cities up to this point. And in fact, Mecca and the Kaaba, which is the main religious site at Mecca, annual pilgrimages to Mecca was already occurring, but it was for a local god. And so Islam was not well received in Mecca at the time, and so Muhammad and his followers went to nearby Medina, which is just north of Mecca, and there was better received. Then in 630, Muhammad went back to Mecca, took over the city, took over the Kaaba, and declared as the house of God, the center of the new faith. And so this journey from Medina to Mecca has been commemorated as an annual pilgrimage called the Hajj. And, you know, Islam had spread very rapidly during the 30 years following the Prophet's death in 632 CE. And so, in order to service the multitudes of Muslim pilgrims who come on the Hajj every year into Arabia, a new network of roads had to be established. And so you see them here. There were primarily four major roads. So the white one, the Yemeni road, primarily serviced the southern Arabians and Muslims from the Horn of Africa. The pink roads serviced pilgrims coming from Africa and actually also Spain. The orange road, called the Damascus Road or the Syrian Road, serviced those coming from the north. And then the two green roads originating in Baghdad and Basra service pilgrims coming from Iraq, Iran, and Central Asia. And the exhibition actually features the Darb Zubaydah, the roads that originated in Basra and Baghdad. And it was the most famous pilgrimage road. It was patroned by Zubaydah, the wife of the caliph at that time, and it was the best. It was well maintained, and it was renowned for having the best amenities for the pilgrims. And so, the objects that were excavated from this one site along the Darb Zubaydah, they were modest, everyday objects that were useful for pilgrims on their journey, but yet they also testify to how imported techniques and products from Iraq and even from Egypt came into the Arabian Peninsula. And so we have, first of all, a group of earthenware painted vessels that were painted in a technique called luster painting that originated in Basra in Iraq. So basically it involved painting with pigments that had silver or copper oxides in it. So then when you fire that in a reduction kiln, meaning you suck all the oxygen out of the environment, it reduces the oxides into a pure metallic state. So then, even without glazing, you just polish the surface and it shines as if it was like metal. Now, archaeologists have found remains of kilns at this one site. And so either Basra potters traveled into Arabia and brought their technology there, or these objects were made in Iraq and then brought into the Arabian Peninsula. Then also from the Darb Zubaydah, we have a group of Egyptian blown glass vessels. Now, during this time period, during the early centuries of Islam, there was actually a robust glass industry that spanned from Egypt in the east to Central Asia in the west. And Islamic glass was very popular for using as gifts, but they were also used during the pilgrimage for trade and exchange, and also for just holding everyday items such as oils, perfumes, and other liquids. And so the destination for all pilgrims was and continue to be Mecca. And the black cube structure that you see in the center there, that is the Kaaba, the designated house of God. And the Hajj became, the Hajj is now one of the five pillars of Islam. And it's the principal duty for every Muslim to make this pilgrimage at least once in their lifetime if they're able. So it is an important time of year for the Muslim community. And certainly for the exhibition, the highlight of the Pilgrimage Road section is this set of gilded doors that had hung on the Kaaba itself until 1947. So the wooden core of the doors were made in the 14th century. The gilding, the gilded decoration that you see on the front was put after in the 17th century due to various floods that had occurred. And here we have actually a historical photograph of this actual set of doors hung on the Kaaba. This is a photograph dating to the 19th century. And one of the essential rituals of the Hajj is actually the circumambulation of the Kaaba. And then at one point, as you can see in the photograph, the fabric covering that covered the Kaaba would be lifted to expose the doors. And then the pilgrims would try to touch the doors. And so after, these doors are now over about 600 years old. And if you look at the gilded decorations, you can certainly see the wear that has been caused due to all the handprints on it. And actually, we knew that this was going to be a problem, but we have visitors who have come to this exhibition, and they actually have tried to touch these doors, even though out of context they're not meant to be sacred anymore, but humans. And so we've taken precautions to try to minimize that. Now, in addition to the Kaaba door, we also have a selection of gifts that were offered to Mecca, Medina, and the Kaaba. And these were royally commissioned gifts, such as this beautiful inlaid incense burner. But some of the more popular gifts included ridiculously large gilded copper candlestick holders, inlaid incense burners, and silver locks and keys. And so for every new power that took over, they became the custodians of the holy cities of Mecca and Medina. And so gifts were regularly offered in this as their sign of devotion. Now, for the multitudes of pilgrims who made it to Mecca for the pilgrimage, some decided to stay, and some even died in Mecca. And so we have, in the exhibition, 18 tombstones that came from a cemetery just north of Mecca. This cemetery was razed to the ground, and the 300-plus tombstones were salvaged. And they provide valuable information about who the deceased were. But for the exhibition, they are definitely remarkable for their range of calligraphy and script. And so we have the tombstones arranged chronologically from the 9th century up until the 16th century. We have examples up to then. And you can clearly see the development of the script from the beginnings, where it was more architectonic and simple, to then just whimsical flourishes of calligraphy. And so we do also have, we wanted to bring the story of the Hajj into contemporary times. And so I stole this idea from the British Museum. They had their exhibition on the Hajj in 2010, I think. And they had done a video project to in which they interviewed local residents who had gone on the Hajj just to get their personal stories. And so we worked with the education department, and we also did a video project in which we interviewed Bay Area Muslims who have gone on the Hajj. And so I wanted to put this project together just to drive home the point that, you know, Islam is a living, practicing religion, and that the Hajj continues today. And that the people that you see on these interviews, they are your friends, your family, your neighbors, your coworkers. And so I do hope that you will go to see the exhibition this weekend before we close on Sunday. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Dani, for that absolutely fascinating talk. I will begin with, just to let you know that the exhibition is open until 5 this afternoon, and from 10 until 9 on Saturday and Sunday. I will begin by... 10 until 5 on Saturday and Sunday. So that's till 5 today and 10 until 5 on Saturday and Sunday. I will begin by asking Dani if there are any docent tours over the next 2.5 days.
Yes, we have daily docent tours. And you can certainly find out when those tours occur either before your visit at our website, or you can certainly call in to the museum, and you can get that information that way. Or you can just simply show up and wait for the next docent tour. But our docents are well-trained, and they are delightful. And the tour would only be 45 minutes, which I have to confess, doing a 30-minute presentation on this exhibition was a challenge, because there's so much more to talk about.
I just found that one of the most fascinating talks, artistic talks that I've ever heard.
Thank you. Very
grateful to have heard it. Did you visit all 5 sites or any of them for the exhibits?
Unfortunately, I didn't get to go to do research for the exhibition. It was already a traveling exhibition by the time it came to us in October. The exhibition was co-organized by the Freer Sackler Museum in Washington, D.C. with the Saudi government. And so about 3 years ago, the exhibition made a European tour in conjunction with the Louvre. And so this past year and a half, it started its North American tour. So it originated in D.C., then it went to Pittsburgh, Houston, Kansas City, then it came to us.
Wow, and so we've got 2.5 days left to see this exhibition. How well has it been attended, and how has it been received?
I am proud to say that we are getting respectable attendance. I think by the end of the exhibition, we should have well over 50,000 visitors, 50,000 visits, so I'm quite happy. And it has been received very favorably. And so I'm proud of that as well. We do work very hard for every exhibition to make, you know, Asian art, history, and culture as accessible as possible. And we can't assume that all of our visitors come in with any knowledge of the region. And that's where we started from. And actually, to be candid, my background is in ancient Chinese art. And so when I took on this project, I myself had to be in the position of, what do I know about this region? And so I think it helped me to then help my visitors go through the exhibition as well.
Which brings us to another question that people are very interested in. How long did it take you to really prepare yourself for this exhibition? Because your presentation was so detailed and so thoroughly knowledgeable.
Oh, thank you. We actually only had a year and a half to work on this exhibition. And ideally, in the museum world, I would have had 3 to 4 years to work on an exhibition. But because this was a traveling show, it was what we consider a package show. That means that, you know, the time period is much shorter. And so, yeah, a year and a half to work on it. And just to, yeah, the majority of it has been on me learning the material. And since it opened in late October, actually, I feel like these past 3 months have been when I gained the most confidence in talking about the show through just all these, the various talks and presentations that I've had the opportunity to give.
Did you have to have much liaising with the Saudi government yourself, or how did that work?
Oh, yes. So since the co-organizers were the Free Recycling Museum in D.C. and the Saudi government, every decision that we had to make, really, we had to get their approval. Because it was a package show, you know, the object list was already chosen, but we had some leeway in choosing how many we can choose to display, because, you know, every museum has their own restrictions in size, etc. And as I had mentioned briefly, I had certain freedoms in how I reorganize certain themes and what I choose to call out versus what I choose to, you know, not call out. And then I had mentioned the special session we had on the diverse languages and scripts. You know, that was something totally new that I wanted to add to the exhibition, and we got the approval for it. And so it was a lot of back and forth. But both institutions were pretty easygoing and, pretty easy to work with.
The video that you were speaking about, that's readily accessible as part of the as an installation at the exhibition?
Yes, yes. So and we hope, yeah. Then after the exhibition closes, we do hope to actually put it online to make it accessible. Not only on our website, but I don't know if you know, but we have thousands of videos that were produced by us that are now available on iTunes University for free. And so, you know, if you're technologically savvy, you can download, you know, these types of lectures, our docent training, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, another thing that our audience is interested in is what was the road by which you became a curator?
Sure. It's a traditional road. I went to undergrad and grad school and majored in Chinese art history. I spent a year in China just to beef up my language skills. And luckily, when I finished my grad program that same year, there were tons of openings for Chinese art curators, you know, at entry-level positions. And I have to say, the museum world is so tiny. And curators, when they get into their position, there's no vacancy until they retire or they die. And so I was very fortunate that there were a handful of positions open in 2007. And, yeah, I applied for the position here at the museum, entry-level curatorial assistant in Chinese art, and I got it. And so that was 7 years ago.
That's fascinating. I'm so glad that there are so many decades ahead of us where we can rely on you to still occupy that position. Here's an interesting question. Was the cultural exchange through the trade of the objects themselves, or was it made through personal contact made by traveling artisans, or both?
Both, actually. A concrete example of both. On Tarut Island, one of the first, the island that had a strong trade relationship with Mesopotamia, Tarut, at that time in the 3rd millennium BCE, it was the center of this very legendary civilization called Dilmun. And Dilmun traded with Mesopotamia in timber, in pearls, dates. And so the relationship began with trade, and then the artistic exchange or the artistic awareness, the artistic relationship, followed that. But then the site, the city of Kiryat Alfa in southern part of the Arabian Peninsula, I had mentioned prior to this presentation that the roads between the Roman Empire and the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula began with a failed Roman expedition. And so Rome was doing trade with Asia off of a port in the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula. And so they had wanted to first peacefully negotiate with the southern Arabian tribes to get more control of this port so that it would be easier and cheaper for them to trade with the rest of Asia. When that didn't work, they decided to go about it by force. Unfortunately, that didn't work either. And so the troops went back home empty-handed, but yet that opened up, physically and metaphorically, the roads between Roman artisans and Arabian artisans.
Fascinating. I have to say there's one extra thing. There are so many things that Dani's talk opened up for me, but my training is actually as a Shakespeare scholar. There is a reference in Comedy of Errors to gold, when you touch it, losing value. There's another reference in that play to a Turkish carpet that Antipholus has. So I believe Shakespeare had some kind of access to knowledge about these gold doors. I can't wait to see if anybody else has thought of that connection. But it came to me from your talk and your picture of the golden doors.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because we've had textual evidence of this famous Arabian incense trade, but it was only until about 40 to 50 years ago when many of these finds first surfaced that now we have visual, tangible, object-based evidence of such a trade. And so this is one of the, one of the benefits of archaeology. Human history can continually be refined as new artifacts surface.
Yeah, that's really fascinating, isn't it, that we actually remake history as we live. So you saw that picture where the doors, by touching, actually were starting to be worn away, the gold. Mm-hmm. It's really fascinating.
And then also I just want to mention another revelation that archaeologists and art historians got from this exhibition, from these finds, was that pre-Islamic Arabia had a profusion of human forms. When you think of Arabia, you think of Saudi Arabia, you only think of the Islamic State. But prior to it being an Islamic state, human forms were everywhere. Mm. And so we actually turned that into a kid activity for the exhibition. So we have this program where we created a backpack, an explorer backpack for the kids, so they can pick up the backpack, and the activity was for them to go through, especially the incense road section of the exhibition, and just deeply look at the various ways that the human form was depicted during this time.
Fascinating. With the funereal form, do you think that was an ideal human face that was conceptualized?
I'd say many of them were. And that's pretty much actually all I can say. We have examples of idealized human forms, but then primarily the other half were schematized human forms. For example, the Neolithic human-shaped steles that I showed at the beginning, and then also the eye stele from Tema, and of course the funerary gold mask. These examples, we would consider them schematized facial features, while the heads that coming out of, for example, Tema or Al-Ula are more idealized, you know, the six-pack man. And I, you know, a little anecdote, I brought my two-year-old son to the exhibition, and when he saw those Neolithic steles, he can clearly point out eyes, nose, and so there's something definitely universal in human representations of human features that even a two-year-old can identify, even though they are rather abstract and schematized.
Yeah. I was fascinated by the eyes being in one form, one face really far apart, and in the other beside it very close together.
Yeah, and you know, because these finds are so recent, the oldest date to like the 1960s, while the most recent were only about 2 years ago, that you know, everything that you see here in this presentation and in the exhibition, this is only the beginning of the research that is possible for the art and artifacts of this region. So it's exciting in that sense.
Yeah. I think we have time for one more question. I would encourage people after this talk to get in touch with Dani. Please go and see the exhibition. When did bronze first appear in the peninsula?
Well, in the exhibition, we don't have it occurring any earlier than, I'd say, than the Roman Empire, in the beginning of the Roman Empire. And so at least that within the parameters of the exhibition, I'm sure we can do, I can certainly do more research to find out even a more accurate time period than that, but. Oh, yes.
Thank you so much for this insightful lecture.
Thank you.
I'm familiar with the area and I visited before. As somebody that has studied ancient Chinese archaeology and artifacts, as well as now this exhibit and all the other exhibits, what is the most surprising element that has enlightened you or has challenged you to think about this region and this area and this work?
Well, certainly coming from a Chinese art background, you know, I'm a little bit biased. I think, you know, the Chinese civilization is one of the longest and most impressive in the world. But, you know, I'm familiar with all the, you know, the Silk Road and the other trade roads that have connected China to many parts of the world. And now I'm learning that, you know, the Arabian Peninsula had such a connection as well that, you know, after the incense left the Arabian Peninsula, it then traveled by boat to India, to China. And so it may, you know, one of the concerns I had when we first took on this exhibition was, how is that relevant to Asian art? You know, we're, our mission is to really expand people's opinions on what is Asia. And because through trade, because through the Islamic tradition, we can certainly say that the art and archaeology of this region, the history of this region, is certainly connected to what we know of Asian art, history, and culture. And so I had a Chinese newspaper reporter ask me, how is this relevant to, you know, the Chinese community? It's certainly relevant because, you know, the Silk Road did not stop in Central Asia. The influence, the ideas went further than that. And the same can be said with what was in the Arabian Peninsula and how much further it may have traveled.
That's a fascinating point. Just for our listening audiences to remind you, we've actually been listening to the Commonwealth Club presentation of the Roads of Arabia. Listening audiences may know less or possibly more than the audience here today, but of course Saudi Arabia is long predated by Arabia, and so the Al Saud family, of course, has given its name to what we now know as Saudi Arabia. But I love the fact that we're thinking about such a huge history.
Yeah. Yes.
It's 1 o'clock, and it is time to experiment with my gavel again. Thank you so much to Dani Chan for her wonderful presentation about the roads of Arabia, archaeology and history of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. We also thank our audiences here, those listening to the recording, and those on the internet. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 110 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned by myself, Philippa Kelly.